economic growth versus environment? Does it really have to be one or the other? We're already seeing costs go up because the living environment, pollinators, reefs, trees, and so forth, is being eroded. Who should be paying up? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. How can the investment equation be tipped to favor sustainability? Call toll-free to 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. What has nature ever done for us? The subject today on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Providence Imaging Center with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. PROVimaging.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, we've done a number of programs with regards to investment and with regards to sustainability and food security, and Lord knows a whole lot about science and the environment. We're going to try and throw them all together into this one and call it Integrating Natural Capital in the Investment Equation. Good morning. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. I hope this will be a lively discussion. We have a great expert to be with us. Joining us by telephone from the United Kingdom is Tony Juniper. Welcome to the show, Tony.
Good morning, Steve. A great pleasure to be able to join in.
Yes, I'm glad you could make the time for us. The weather's been bad in the United Kingdom, as I understand, but clearing up now?
We've had some wild weather here since before Christmas, some extreme storms. We've had flooding right across the United Kingdom. We've had people without power in some parts of the country for many days on end, including over Christmas. But we have a bit of a respite tomorrow, at least where I am in Cambridge, in the east of England. We're looking forward to a nice sunny day tomorrow, so hopefully a bit of a rest.
Yes. Tony is the author of What Has Nature Ever Done For Us? How Money Really Does Grow on Trees. It was originally published in the United Kingdom and now has been published in the United States by Synergetic Press. And it is an encyclopedia. You know what it reminds me of, Tony, is you probably know these because you're old enough to remember them. Lester Brown's old books that he used to put out, the updates from the World Watch Institute.
I know them very well, and great inspiration to me during my career as an environmental campaigner, a great source of information, and also a great source of analysis. So Lester's work not only presenting us with the numbers, but also what the numbers mean. And actually one of the things that I always found from his work that was always very powerful was how he managed to tell a story behind a big concept from the point of view of a person. So for example, a Chinese farmer getting his first mobile phone and then talking about mobile technology spreading across the Asian continent and taking the bigger trends from the story of the individual person. I always found that very, very persuasive as a way of putting information over.
You know, now that you bring it up, one that always inspired me was he was writing about recycling and junk, and he said, you really have to go to the dumps to see the kind of enterprise that people can have making stuff out of the stuff that they find there to add value and glean a living. He said, it's just amazing, and there's no accounting system that accounts for it.
No, quite. And in the developing countries, one sees that in spades, in parts of India, for example, and the way in which refuse, you know, what we take for granted is stuff that goes in the bin in the more developed countries. In other parts of the world, that's seen as a resource. And, you know, in some ways, these are the kinds of ideas I'm trying to unearth in the book, in talking about the ways in which nature does things and the ways in which we might be inspired to do things better ourselves. And one of the things that I guess comes out near the top of the list is to realize that nature does not do waste. It uses it. And the ingenuity of humankind, I don't think, is limited in the way in which we could avoid putting stuff into bins, landfills, and incinerators, and to be finding ways in hanging on to those resources instead of making good use of them.
Well, I'm busy writing that down now. Nature does not do waste. And I like that. I don't remember that being directly quoted in the book. Maybe I missed it.
No, I know. I think maybe we'll put that in the next one.
Well, excellent. Tony Juniper, author of What Has Nature Ever Done for Us, is with us by telephone from the United Kingdom. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. I got an email inquiry already, and there will be more because our listeners love to chew on this sustainability and investment question. And I think one of the reasons is that nobody's really got the answers. But what you've provided here in this book, Tony, is kind of an encyclopedia of things we might not realize that nature is always doing for us that have an economic value. And that means when they go away, like for instance, a kelp forest goes away, you get more storm surge that people don't necessarily account for, that we need to find a way to account for. And that's the part that challenges. But before we go to all that stuff, I want to ask you a little bit about yourself, because you ran Friends of the Earth for what? Like you were associated with Friends of the Earth and probably still are. I think you're a board member for like what? Decades now.
Yeah, for a very long time. I began my career working at Friends of the Earth, running the campaign to save the tropical rainforests back in 1990, and I was involved in lots of different work we did there on different environmental challenges, on climate change, on transport, on sustainable agriculture, biodiversity, on waste, on water and air pollution, all of these different subjects that have been in and out of focus over the years. And I finished up running the organization from 2003 until 2008. And for a very long time, I was on the board of Friends of the Earth International as well. So this was a very big part of my life. And I look back on that with a sense of exhaustion in some ways. It was really hard work, but it was enormous fun. And look back with a great deal of contentment, really, at how much we did in terms of changing the way many corporations and governments think about these subjects, and also changing the law in very tangible ways. But I do feel at the moment that we are slightly in reverse on some of these questions, which is actually why I wrote the book, and I think we'll come to some of that later on, Steve. But the time at Friends of the Earth for me really was a formative period, and I hope I learned something there about communications, actually, apart from anything else, and just having a sense of, you know, how some of these things need to be talked about, because they are quite technical subjects with a lot of science behind them, and trying to turn that into plain English is one of the things that I do today, and hence that most recent book, which is trying to capture some of these subjects around environmental economics and turning it into something that everybody can read and hopefully get something from.
Well, one of the things you have a lot of notes from is your encounters with various government and corporate leaders. And it strikes me there that you find in many cases that there are very good intentions. When competition starts, if you run a business and you're trying to run it sustainably and you have a planning horizon, say, or a corporate goal of so-and-so by 2020 or whatever, and the competition doesn't, you might be at a disadvantage.
Absolutely. And this is really why I wrote the book, is because, you know, one of the big conclusions I've reached over the years is how environmental problems are not really environmental problems at all. They're generally a reflection of economics that's gone wrong. And if you look at the way in which companies compete and governments try to grow their economies, the reason why they're destroying nature and putting pollution into the atmosphere and changing the climate and destroying the natural resource base is because it doesn't have a value. It's appearing on nobody's balance sheet. Nobody's paying for the damage, and nobody's being asked to account for the loss of value that's occurring to society as a whole. And so that's why people carry on doing what they do. And as you say, you know, there are some good souls out there in the business world who know this, and they know that something needs to be done. But if they do the right thing for the environment, they do the wrong thing for their business, and they go out of business if they don't play this carefully. So this then takes me to the conclusion that we really need to be changing economics as well as appealing to the good instincts of people in powerful positions, because even when people in powerful positions understand this and know that something's got to be done, very often they can't do it because the economic rules and metrics that get into the news and which get onto the shareholders' blackberries and onto the TV and everything else, these numbers are taking us in a different direction. So we really need to start changing the way in which we're looking at economic value, in my opinion. And this is one of the very exciting things that's coming out of these discussions around the value of nature in recent years, because once we start to understand what nature is doing in protecting coasts from floods, in replenishing fish stocks, in pollinating crops, in taking carbon out of the atmosphere, and you name it, all these different things, then you start to generate some really big financial numbers. And then, of course, the challenge is, how do you reflect those numbers in transactions, prices, and in economic measurement? And that's a very exciting field which is beginning to unfold across the world at the moment. And I do think, ultimately, will be how we get to a more sustainable planet is through this route of more rational and more comprehensive economics.
So it could be just a matter of what people put in their financial disclosures. If it were formatted in a different way,
yeah.
It might also change the way that the financial analysts look at the risk of the investment, because it's probably the risk side of it that's going to tip it. And you see this, I think, in the insurance industry right now.
Yes.
Where, and you know, Lloyd's, of course, you know, is in your neighborhood almost. But, I mean, they almost have to start calculating these things. And they did it, for instance, on flood insurance and increasingly on other things. And they were among the first first industries, really, to start calling for a carbon tax. Because
absolutely,
they said we need to level the playing field, and this is the only way we're going to do it.
Absolutely, and for the insurance industry, I'm sure there'll be many questions being asked in this country in the coming weeks after these terrible floods here. The insurance companies will be really, really hurting after this. This will cost them billions, these disastrous periods of extreme weather we've had in recent months just in this country. And that industry, it sees the bottom line impacts of these kinds of changes very quickly. And as you say, Steve, you know, the insurance companies have been there for some time, the first big industrial sector worldwide, saying that we do need to do something about climate change, not because, you know, we've got some science or because we think something might happen in the future, because we're actually measuring it now. And if you look at the way in which insured losses have been rocketing upwards over the last 20 years, and just look at the curves that are being produced by companies like Swiss Re and Munich Re, you realize that environmental skepticism really is unfounded when you come from that kind of business sector, because it is happening and it's causing real economic stresses and strains. And there's other risks, of course, that come with other industries. But I think this is actually where we will start to get the attention coming from the big investment houses, because they will start to see systemic risk beginning to emerge. It's already there, but I think it will become more obvious as time goes on. And that, I think, will be another source of action that takes us into this world of trying to look at different kinds of economic valuation of natural systems.
Have you had any, you know, I don't know, as you said, you've been involved in this since this is 1990. Have you had occasion to talk with policy people over in China? Because what's happening is a lot of the marketing and securities and investment is increasingly global. So there was
indeed
a point in the United States, for instance, when the large pension funds, and we've seen them exercise their clout from time to time, because they are major shareholders, could make a difference sometimes in the policies of the corporations. But with global investment, you know, the China's kind of the giant in the room right now.
It is. China, India, Brazil, Mexico, Russia, all of these countries are having an increasingly big impact on the state of the global trends. I think as far as China is concerned, you know, I think sometimes in Western countries we get a little bit too dismissive of what China thinks of all of this in terms of their political elite and what some of their companies believe. It's true that they're having this explosive period of economic growth. It is causing a big addition to some of these global burdens of greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere in particular, but also demand for natural resources, timber and land and fish. All these things are being reflected in Chinese growth rates. But I think sometimes, you know, we see that and we think, oh, well, the Chinese really don't get this. They're not interested. But in fact, I think they are. And, you know, they see this in a way which is not only, again, about the theoretical science. It's also reflected in some of the issues they're dealing with at home. You know, they have water issues. They have desertification issues. And in a more local sense, in terms of the way their economy is going, they've got terrible pollution questions, which are also leading into political issues. issues too. And if you look at the number of demonstrations that went on in China over the last few years, there were literally thousands of them, people protesting about different ways in which the country was going. And nearly all of these protests were environmental. They were about water pollution and toxic waste being left into rivers and what have you that were getting into the drinking water and harming people. So China's acutely aware of this, both the global challenges seen in the desertification, the more local challenges seen in pollution, and both of those things being looked at by the government there as a security issue. And so, you know, but they've got this problem because the growth that they've been giving to a proportion of their population, the rest of the population wants that too. And so the big question there is, can the country leapfrog quickly enough to the clean technologies that are going to enable the country to continue to bring more comfortable lifestyles to people who would like them, at the same time as keeping these big issues under control and in time beginning to diminish the impact on things like the global atmosphere. That's a massive tall order, but I don't think the Chinese are blind to it. And if you look at the way in which they're investing in battery technology, for example, the fact that they're now the world's biggest installer of wind farms, they are producing solar panels on a bigger scale than anybody else. I do think that they've understood the connections. And so I'm hopeful that some of these big economies, you know, that we sometimes see as being a big part of the problem, in a few years' time, hopefully they'll start to look more like a big bit of the solution.
I'm wondering if we're dealing in some ways with just the length of time that feedbacks take. And I say that because of the way that you open the book. The first book, for many people, would say, what in the world does this have to do with how much money things are worth in the natural environment when you've got this bunch of people out in New Mexico who build a dome and put a bunch of plants and stuff inside of it and manage to keep themselves sealed in there, like 7-8 people sealed inside there, or is it 10, for 2 years?
Yes, 8 people for 2 years. The project you're referring to, Steve, is for listeners who may not have come across this, is a project called Biosphere 2, and it was an attempt to recreate a microcosm of the Earth's system inside a sealed dome in the Arizona desert near the Tucson. For me, this was a really very powerful metaphor about how much we take our Earth for granted, because when you seal a bit of the atmosphere away, and as you say, put plants and animals and water inside, and then put 8 people in there with nothing but those bits of atmosphere, water, and plants and animals to survive, you realize just how intricate the thing is that we rely on for our economic growth and development and our welfare. And the challenges that came with being able to take that piece of captive nature and to manage it so that those people remained healthy and had enough to eat, enough to drink, and everything else is really quite, it's a monumental challenge. And yet we take the Earth that we're destroying systematically, pretty much in terms of many of the life support systems, and we assume it will continue doing what it does without us having to maintain it. And the Biosphere 2 project, the amount of effort and thought and engineering and planning that went into keeping that little bit of nature going, I think spoke volumes about the way in which we need to be looking at our Earth, because what was needed in order to make that project work was a very careful assessment of how human needs could be met without destroying the little systems that were inside the dome. So the agricultural area, the rainforest, the coral reef, all of these things that were put inside, they had to be kept intact in order to keep the people healthy. Whereas in the real world, outside the dome, we destroy nature, and we think that's the way to keep people healthy, when in fact it's the opposite. Looking after nature is the way we're going to be able to do this long term. And the only difference between the dome and the whole Earth is the time scales, because the dome began to malfunction when people did certain things in terms of the composition of oxygen or carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the way the agriculture was working or not. And these kinds of changes that you see in the microcosm there very swiftly occurring, because it's so small, these are the kinds of changes that will occur on Earth if we don't begin to start looking at things differently in terms of what natural systems are doing for us in terms of food production, clean air, clean water, nutrient recycling, and all the rest of these things. And so Biosphere 2, for me, was a really wonderful eye-opener, and I hope a lot of the readers who've picked up the book will find the same thing, and some real wisdom that came from the pioneers who built that in terms of the mindset needed to keep planet Earth functioning.
Well, I came at it from the space cadet point of view. I was one of those people who wanted to be a spaceman, and you know, reading science fiction in the 1950s, I avidly followed every possible type of like a teenager following hot rods or whatever, or sports teams. You know, I was following whatever was going on in the space program for years and years and years. And, you know, finally, come 1969, somebody finally walks on the moon, and it was like, this is it, you know, the everything will be different from now on, I thought. And then, you know, a couple years later, nobody came to the moon since.
Nobody went back.
Yeah, what I did is I moved into science journalism, and I started getting obsessed with space habitation, and I quickly learned the word closure. Closure is the idea of when do you, okay, so you have a space habitat, when can you stop shipping stuff up from Earth and it can close in and actually keep itself going? And this was, it was very interesting. They were all about technical fixes at the time. They were about, well, of course we'd have to use hydroponics, and we have to, burn all our waste and turn it into ash and those mineral salts then recycled, on and on and on like that. Biosphere 2 was done in a different way, by making it larger and by using the existing biological diversity of the entire Earth. They tried to build a system that would actually be a self-sustaining living system based on the ideas of Verdansky, who noticed that you could close a bottle of water and guess what? Stuff stays alive in there.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. No, it was an ambitious and conceptual leap, the like of which you rarely see.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. We've been talking about Biosphere 2, which is the subject of the opening chapter of Tony Juniper's What Has Nature Ever Done For Us? How Money Really Does Grow on Trees. He's with us by phone from the United Kingdom. And the book essentially goes into the economic values of various things that we take for granted about our own environment, particularly the living systems in there. And it's sort of pointed towards some kind of new economics that nobody really knows how to define. Wouldn't you say?
I think we're getting there. It's fiendishly complicated, but it is doable. And I think, you know, some of the tools that are being developed in recent years are beginning to enable us to do this. One is so-called payments for ecosystem services. This is when you can work out the value of a particular job being done by a bit of nature, and then you find a way of transferring money from the people who are benefiting from that to the people who are providing it. And so some of the classic examples, and actually we've got some good examples of this unfolding in the UK right now. There's another great example from New York City, which I cover in the book, which is basically looking at the way in which you can create an economic structure which enables you to supply water more cheaply to consumers through looking after the natural systems that are providing it. So instead of building concrete reservoirs and spending a lot of money on very expensive equipment to remove particles from drinking water, finding the ways to provide the fewer financial resources needed to keep pastures and forests healthy in order to get the water both kept in the environment in a way where it can be taken out, so basically a green reservoir that's holding the water in nature, and also which is also filtering and cleaning the water in a way which means you don't have to do that with technology and engineering. And so that is a very rational way of looking at how you might get water. And then the economic structure that makes that happen is basically taking a small amount of money from consumers and putting it through the water company and spending it in the countryside in asking farmers to do, or landowners to do, different kinds of practices which keep that green infrastructure intact. And so That's cheaper for the consumer. The landowners like it. The water company likes it because they're having to invest less money in equipment. And then you have the co-benefits that come with this, which are absolutely immense in some of these cases. So in this case, you have countryside that is for available for hiking, for bird watching, for fishing, for cross-country skiing, which is great for public health. And also you have the conservation of the wildlife, which is obviously of benefit to society. Study after study tells us that. And then also you have the carbon held in the trees and in the soils, which are in a much healthier state because of the way they're being managed. And so that is all mediated through this economic structure called payments for ecosystem services. But it requires you to go out into the field and to measure the nature and to work out what value it's got and then to come up with these kinds of schemes. And actually more complicated than the economics in that kind of thing really is the negotiation with the landowners and the people who are looking after the land.
Not to interrupt you or anything, but did you say New York City?
Yes, New York City, yes.
You're saying that New York City's water supply, that they discovered that in order to clean up their water would cost more than it would be to just pay the farmers to let the land be a natural sponge.
That's exactly it.
This
is one of the very famous examples of how this kind of thing can work. And actually that now is the largest unfiltered water supply in the United States that came from this very far-sighted arrangement that was put in place during the 1990s and has carried forward since. And it's been an inspiration in other parts of the world. I talk about a similar example which is being developed in Bogota in Colombia. And we have examples here in the United Kingdom which are beginning to emerge, where you have the water companies, these are private companies, looking for ways to be able to secure supply for people. They're under political pressure because of the way the economy has gone, so they're being asked to keep the costs of the water down. And some of the things they're now looking at which enable them to do that is basically going back to nature and protecting the natural systems that are providing the clean water without a big investment of technology that costs a lot of money, which is then passed on to the people who are paying the water bills.
Reflecting natural capital in the investment equation is what we're talking about and looking for ways to get to with Tony Juniper. What has nature ever done for us? How money really does grow on trees. The title of his book from Synergetic Press. And you talk about a bioeconomy. What would that be?
Yes. So the conclusion I reached at the end of doing all this thinking and research and writing over a period of years was that, you know, we need a different kind of economy, really. And actually, this was very much inspired by the thinking behind Biosphere 2, whereby you don't have an economy that you're trying to balance against environmental damage and saying, well, on the one hand, you need to have economic growth, and on the other, we have to have some pollution. I'm trying to take the conversation slightly beyond that and to be thinking about how would you design an economic system that basically maximizes the value of nature to the human economy. So rather than degrading it and taking bits of it out and turning them into consumer products or everything else, what kind of an approach would you take towards economics if you kept the natural systems intact so that they looked after people long into the future? And of course, then you have to start getting beyond our simple, simplistic free market economic system. And actually, I'm not speaking against market economics in the book. What I'm talking about is markets having real information. So if we're treating nature as free in a market transaction, when in fact nature is worth a lot, and the fact that nature is worth a lot is not being reflected in the prices we're paying for services and goods, that is not a sensible economy. It's not a market economy. It's a partial market economy with only a bit of the information in it. So really my bioeconomy idea is about bringing this information into real numbers and finding ways of reflecting those into the different prices that we see in the wild, and lots of different ways of doing that. Taxes is one way. So ecological taxes on carbon, for example, could be used by governments at the same time as reducing income tax. And so you could have the same tax burden in a society, but instead of getting it from people's wages, you'd get some of it from carbon instead. And so this then sends a very clear signal to people about the need to to move to lower carbon electricity and transport. More electric cars would be sold. You'd have more people buying and installing renewable electricity. All of these things would naturally flow because suddenly the market had the real information it needs to be able to function. There's all sorts of other tools you could use. I've mentioned payments for ecosystem services. That would be another one. You could have a route that is based upon different kinds of economic measures so that the country, when it reports its annual GDP, instead of just saying we've got 2% growth in GDP, you would also need to look at the state of the natural capital. Have we got more forests? Has our carbon dioxide emissions gone up? What's the state of our soil? Do we have more pollinating insects? Are our coastal wetlands that defend us from storms in good shape or not? All these things would be brought in as part of the measurements. And so you wouldn't simply look at the financial wealth in the economy. You'd look at the natural wealth, the natural capital, and also look at the happiness of people. And this is one thing that I think is the biggest oversight in most market economies worldwide. If the economy is for one thing, surely it's to make people happy and to provide for people's welfare. And we don't actually measure that when we're looking at 2% GDP.
Tony, you're starting to talk like a Venezuelan now. And let me tell you, your ideas are catching on. You're really going into full swing now, and the Shire is lighting up the phone lines from down in Homer at the end of the road. The hobbits are dying to talk to you, and let's take one call now. Roberta in Homer, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, how's things down in Homer today?
Yeah, too warm. But we'll try to get over it.
All right.
So I've been working on environmental issues for about 30 years down here in Homer. And right now we have a governor that is making that extremely difficult. And we keep getting told that oil and gas industry and mining are what is going to get us by, and we have to have jobs. And I keep banging my head against the wall of trying to come up with some ideas of sustainable jobs that I can use as an argument when I get told, well, we have to have gas as the bridge because we can't turn on a dime, even though ocean acidification became a factor at least 3 years ago, and I literally thought we were going to turn on a dime because who in their right mind would continue to think it was okay to destroy our oceans? So can you give me any ideas that I could use when I'm talking to politicians and oil and gas companies that I can very smartly say, well, this is what we've got to do?
Tony, before you answer that, I'm going to take our break because otherwise I can tell this would go for a while. Roberta, I want to thank you very much for that question, and also compliment you on your steadfast environmental work down through the years. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Well, definitely people in Homer are responding to the message of Tony Juniper, the author of What Has Nature Ever Done For Us? How Money Really Does Grow on Trees. It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about reaching towards sustainability yet one more time, trying to integrate natural capital in the investment equation. At one point, Tony points out that there's $80 trillion of investment capital out there swimming around looking for some place to invest. So if it gets different signals, it would behave differently. And Tony, Roberta asked just before the break, give me some talking points that I can use to say, here's our sustainable ways of having jobs here in Alaska, where we're very dependent on extractive industries?
Yes. So a very, very good question, Roberta, and congratulations on keeping going for 30 years. I've got about that much under my belt as well. It can be exhausting, but take heart from the fact that we are getting somewhere. And, you know, I think we are getting to the crux of the debate increasingly, which is about, you know, how are we going to create jobs in an economy? How are we going to be able to create the dynamism and the demand that's going to keep things going in a way where people can have a good life? And for me, this is about, you know, moving towards a circular economy. And so it kind of goes back to what I said at the beginning. You know, nature does not do waste, and our economy need not do waste as well. And this is not about going back to some kind of Stone Age existence. It's about going forward with the incredible technology and ingenuity we've got at our fingertips to be able to do things differently. And so you mentioned oil and gas, and, you know, that's a big issue over here right now as well, especially with shale gas, hydraulic fracking, which has been going on in the U.S., I know, and made a big difference there. People want to do it here. And the big argument around all of that is about energy security, jobs, and the economy, as you'd expect. And the way it's being countered, I think, most effectively, is to be talking about the huge opportunities that we've got. And I don't know Alaska very well, but I would think probably you've got the same kind of thing going on there, whereby if you can get the investment there, the renewable energy technologies is the way to go in terms of being able to build industrial strength, being able to deal with the energy demand issues at the same time as being able to create jobs, export opportunities, and competitive enterprises. And, you know, here we've got a very big wind industry in the UK now, and it's really quite incredible, actually, how in a relatively short time this industry has grown pretty dramatically to the point now where there's three times more people employed in the wind industry in the UK, the wind power industry, than is employed in the coal industry. That's how big it's grown. We're sitting on here, as I'm sure you are in that part of the world, an enormous opportunity with wave and tidal power too. And these kinds of technologies are in their infancy. But if we can find ways to get research and development accelerated, then these things could be absolutely massive. And these are not pansy little industries that don't really count. This is big scale, serious offshore engineering that we employ a lot of people, and if it can be made to work, we'll have a massive global demand behind it as well. So these are the kinds of things I talk about, and I talk about agriculture as well. I point out how some of the farmers in this country who I know, who are, you know, running small-scale enterprises producing vast amounts of food, they're doing it with a low amount of fossil fuels, a low amount of chemicals. They're doing it in a way which is helping the soil, and they're doing it in a way which is employing more people. And the difference is that they're spending money on people's wages rather than on pesticides and fertilizers and equipment. So it's kind of changing the structure of farming to shift the economics so that labor becomes an advantage rather than poisons and machines being the advantage. Now, of course, when you start talking about all this kind of stuff, you finish up running straight into the vested interests, because the people who sell chemicals, combine harvesters, oil rigs, and gas drilling equipment, they really don't want to hear this. You know, there is a bit of an issue there. Although, you know, amongst some of these companies, you can find enlightened individuals who would say, okay, well, you know, what's the pathway to get out of what we're in now and into something different? And it kind of comes back to Steve's point at the beginning about, you know, the competitive pressures. And, you know, you've got to do X, Y, and Z to succeed in this sector. And even if you know and care about these bigger issues, you can't do them because it's not something that's going to give you a business advantage, which then I think takes you kind of beyond the specific industries and into a conversation with the politicians and also with the investment community, the people with the big bucks, that's going to make a difference in terms of reorienting how we do things. But I know exactly what you're saying, and I think probably, you know, I don't know what kind of resources you've got there, but maybe the Alaskan environmental groups could get together and do something, a piece of research with some academics, which, you know, you could call Sustainable Alaska, and really, really focus on the job side, go out and do the number crunching, and then take your top five messages from that to the lobbying and to the work you do in trying to convince companies. And I do think we've got a good story to tell here.
Hey, Tony. Would you possibly do a little free consulting for us? Or we do another Talk of Alaska and bring these people in and say, and we could kind of kick it all around in a show, maybe.
Oh, I'd love to.
Oh, wonderful.
I'd love to come over and help. Yeah. I'd be delighted.
I want to add a couple of items for Roberta. One is, in Alaska, we don't have good metrics for picking up our sustainable jobs. Second, we have a good, we are, innovation has bigger bang for the buck in Alaska. We do know that, even if it's a field where people think it's impossible, like agriculture, We're starting to have a larger agricultural sector in the far north. And, of course, we had hardly any, so any growth shows up as pretty massive growth. And also really illustrative is the Federal Aviation Administration just has approved Alaska as part of a test range for drone aircraft, remotely piloted aircraft, which are used for research as well as warfare, as you may know, and for a number of remote sensing applications. And it's going to be a situation where the government is not paying for it. The private sector is going to have to be paying for this experimentation. And because Alaska is now allowed to do it, they're predicting thousands of jobs from that just over the next couple of years as these corporations have to locate here in order to run their tests to try and get on top with this breakthrough technology. And yeah, I think you're right. Also, I think in the tidal energy, as time goes on, we may very well see our countries working together, Tony.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of similarities in terms of the latitude and everything else. I mean, we're not quite as far north as you, but we've got similar challenges. The other thing, actually, Steve, I should mention in answer to Roberta's question, of course, is the fishing industry and the extent to which moving towards more sustainable practices there can create more income, more benefit for coastal communities. So that's another sector where I think there's huge opportunities. And from what little I know from my work outside where you all are there, you know, I think Alaska, the fishing communities there have been showing some real leadership in being able to make these steps towards more sustainable use of those incredibly valuable marine resources.
Oh, boy, now you've started it. Boy, that's the last thing you want to bring up on this show, I'm telling you, fish. Boy, you stepped in it there, Tony. Well, I'm going to ignore it and try and move on to this call from Sally and Jeff, who you may or may not be able to help with this one. But they say, in regards to Biosphere, what would Biosphere 2, that is, what about Biosphere 1? What would the equivalent world population be if the ideal man-made environment of the Biosphere project were to be extrapolated to the world's landmass?
Well, that's a great question. And actually, you've kind of picked up a thought that's right at the end of the book, which is about, you know, the fact that there were 8 people in Biosphere 2, and in Biosphere 1, which is the Earth, where we all live, there's 8 billion. So it's a billion times more people. And I think the Earth's probably a bigger entity than a billion times bigger than Biosphere 2. But, you know, the carrying capacity in terms of what we can take out of the Earth is the big $64 million question. You know, and I think, you know, rather than trying to answer the question of, you know, how many people can we have, I think it's probably important first to ask the question of, you know, what are they going to do? Are they all going to be having a massive car and a huge house and loads of consumer goods and eating meat and unsustainable fish and using large amounts of natural resources? Or are they going to be living in a different kind of economy where they're very happy and having everything they need, but doing it in a way where everything's being recycled and there's very low waste and there's low emissions to the environment because people are using renewable energy and electric vehicles and everything else? And so, you know, because if you say everybody's going to be doing the first lifestyle, then maybe the world population can be something like 1 billion. If you look at the second lifestyle with people living a good life but with much less environmental impact, maybe we could have 10 billion. And so, you know, I think that's the way to look at that question. With current lifestyles, we're way over the edge already. The greenhouse gas emissions numbers are the ones which I think, you know, really kind of give us the scale of change that's needed.
Well, the ocean acidification may turn out to be even quicker feedback, as it turns out.
Yeah,
I have to throw, you know, you're talking utopian right now, Tony, and I have to throw a little healthy skepticism in here from Ken by email, who says, the eco-economy, a valuable input in the economy based on the value of nature, would be the concept of the non-person. That is, for every human removed, the eco-economy would receive a huge boost.
No, I don't buy that. I don't buy that. I
mean, I'm
the
sorry.
Economy is there for the people, so when we want the people, we want to look after them. So, although, you know, I suppose you could construct an argument that would go in that direction, but I don't think people would vote for it.
No, but also I think realistically there's always feedbacks operating on population. First off, the one that involves social status and what people choose to do when they're free of their economic bondage, that's A. But also B, there are also feedbacks of diseases and pathologies and early death and bad infant mortality and so on and so forth that happens in circumstances of bad bad public health. Let's go to Tom, joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tom. How are things down in Homer? We heard it was a little warm.
Yeah, it is. Thanks for taking my call. So, you know, there's many things need to be done to protect the Earth, but we've got to get a priority list and accomplish those items first or our existence on Earth ain't going to exist. For example, if we lose our electrical grid, we'll have a nuclear power plants, 500 of them down around the world, and the radiation will make the Earth unlivable. So we have to focus on the most important items first and get them accomplished. This electrical grid can be hardened and protected, but it's been ignored. And we had a solar flare in the 1850s that took down the telegraph system and burnt the electric or the railroad ties on the railroad. And in 1920, we had another solar flare that took down all the power plants. And we're just hanging by a string if we don't focus on the important items first.
Tom, I want to thank you for that about the infrastructure.
Indeed. And I think you're right, Tom. You know, priorities is a helpful way of channeling the resources and the attention and everything else. And when it comes to power, you know, as well as maintaining grids and infrastructure and everything else, switching the power sources has got to be one of the things near the top of the global list, and getting away from fossil fuels and towards cleaner alternatives. And as I said earlier on, you know, as far as I can see and from what I've learned over the years, you know, those alternatives, they're within reach. Some of them are already working. Wind power in this country is making a big impact. Solar power is making a big impact across different bits of Africa. We have geothermal, we have wave, we have tidal, we have biomass, we have ground source heat pumps, we have some role for liquid biofuels. You know, this can be done, and it can be done in a way which is going to create great wealth for companies that are trailblazing there. It's going to create good returns for investors, and it's going to create a shed load of jobs. But we need to move on it. And of course, you know, the incumbents, the people who are already doing this job for us, the oil, coal, and gas companies, you know, they'd much rather carry on with the business they're doing. So this is, in some ways, it's a bit of a political challenge as well as one to do with technology. But I think, you know, the world is waking up to the need to do this, not least because of all these extreme conditions that are beginning to occur across the world. It's day in, day out. It's in the news. It's in the newspapers. And so I think, you know, the political situation will change quite soon as more and more people put two and two together and realize that the answer is renewables.
Thanks, Tom, for your call. I'm sure Tom wants a good hardened, still wants a good hardened infrastructure, and is convinced that there are ways of transmitting power that would not involve the loss over distance that we have at the present time. And Tom, I'm sure you'll be back to be talking about that as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority would like to recognize businesses and organizations that employ Alaskans who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions. When you hire a mental health trust beneficiary, you're not just providing a job. You're providing an opportunity to showcase unique skills, a strong work ethic, and a desire to succeed. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
We're talking about integrating natural capital in the investment equation with Tony Juniper, author of What Has Nature Ever Done for Us? And Stu joined the program through email by saying that there's a push-pull involved. It's good process that can turn the trick sometimes. And her example was, it was the extreme environmental opposition that forced the so-called, quote, extreme environmental opposition that forced engineers and investors to make the Trans-Alaska Pipeline as successful an engineering feat as it has been. Not perfect, but certainly far better than initially proposed, and that's why efforts to streamline permitting are misguided. Thanks for that, Sue. And this one here, you'll like this one, I think, as Jason joins the program from Nunaka Valley. Jason, welcome to Talk of Alaska from beautiful Nunaka Valley.
Thank you for taking the call. Earlier you mentioned argument towards people, and I'm going to have to reference more of a Christian mentality that we were cast out of the garden, and it strikes me as a blasphemy to God to disrespect that garden. And so that comes back to sort of the personal selfishness is not necessarily what nature does for us, but what we can do for nature. As for some of the more the larger social impacts, I think that the personal impact seems to have far wider-reaching importance. The decision if you get in your car or if you get what you buy at your store, what's how you live in your house, how you heat your house, how you keep warm, what clothes you wear. And that selfishness also goes on to what happens to the waste. And it seems that as long as you don't have to deal with the residual of the styrofoam cup, you don't mind using a styrofoam cup, but the folks in Alabama or in, around the world in China, they get all the waste in the backyard, which seems like a fairly rude thing. So if you want to be happy, you should be able to extend that same happiness to your neighbor, which sort of comes up to the last little hit point on where we can go from this is we have very many models of what our society can look at, being if we look at the turn of the 19th century, the 20th century, and from the 20th to 21st, all the technologies that we're still working on were worked out 100 years ago, whether it be electric cars and energy transmission and the mass transit, remembering that our cities had every city was ranked on its level of mass transit because we want to move, but cars don't make sense, carts don't make sense, horses take food, cars take gasoline. And it strikes me that, now we've got a great deal of resources, but we're a little bit like the frog in the pot waiting for something to happen. And when the frog decides to jump out of the pot, then we can have a real conversation. So when we start taking more of a personal role in your day-to-day life, if you don't care for using your car, then start walking. And pretty soon your neighbors will pick you up, and pretty soon your community will have a bus system, and now pretty soon there'll be less cars there. And it doesn't mean that your standard of living is changing. It just means you chose to use your resources in another fashion. And now those resources from one area can now be gone, can be allocated elsewhere. It's a great conversation. And I'll tell you what, we had better start looking after our gardens as human beings and as Christians. It's time we start waking up.
Yes, I think, Tony, you're probably going to agree with just about all of that, especially that part about gardening. We really should be gardening the earth. Thanks, Jason, for that.
Indeed. No, I think that's a very good way of looking at it. And one thing I'd really welcome, actually, is more of the faith communities who've got some theological perspectives on all of these things to be talking more about it to the people who share the faith. And it would be good to hear in this country and around the world more Christian leaders perhaps making some of these points to help the politics move along, because this is very much core to many faiths, looking after the earth as a moral agenda, as well as one which is about science and technology. And I think that's a very powerful perspective, and I'd love to see more of that kind of conversation going on to be encouraging people to think a little differently. And actually, when it comes to individuals and people, I've come to learn over the years that there's really three big forces shaping the outcomes that we're heading towards. One is the governments who make laws. Another one is the companies and their investors who choose technologies and back them or not. And then the third big force is what we all think as individuals and what we say to our political leaders and what we say through our shopping. When we go to buy a vehicle or a tin of soup or whatever it happens to be, we're making choices the whole time. And if more of us began to exercise choices which reflected this analogy of the garden, then I think, the process of change would go all the more quickly. So there's a very powerful and profound piece there about all of us as actors in culture change, because it isn't simply something, that's handed down by a scientist or by a policymaker. These things change because society is changing and people's demands and expectations are changing, and we've all got a role in that part, I think.
Very, very interesting, and we get to really deep philosophical questions pretty quickly there. Ones we've been around at other times in this program, because we have had people in the ministry who do really believe in stewardship in that way. Let's go to George, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, George.
Hello, thank you. Yeah, I wanted to comment, on the idea about how the insurance companies are seeing the importance of dealing with climate change, but they aren't the only ones. The World Bank and the IMF are very concerned about this. The head of the International Monetary Fund said recently that the most critical need in the world today is to get financing flowing into renewable energy, because they see that that climate change threatens everything that they've been working on for years and years and years. I think one of the things that's really critical is that the United States, if we really see ourselves as leaders in the world, to show leadership. I think it's really critical for our politicians, members of Congress and the president and whatnot, to show real leadership in this and say, we are going to take the bull by the horns and do something about it.
Well, I couldn't agree more with that. And, you know, I think, you know, the leadership, it's got so many dimensions. But I think, you know, the countries that have got relatively strong economies and relatively comfortable populations, you know, we do need to go first, especially when you look at the historical responsibility. In the UK right now, where I live, you hear politicians sometimes saying, well, there's no point in us doing anything because the Chinese are doing so much worse, and whatever we do is going to be overwhelmed by the Chinese pollution. But when you look at the per capita pollution of Great Britain over the last 150 years and look at that in a World League table, we come out as the number one polluter per person in the world. You know, and if that isn't a source of moral responsibility and a basis for leadership, I don't know what is. And the United States is up there too. And so I think, you know, for these kinds of reasons, you know, we've got every good reason in the rich countries to be really going for this and to be setting an example. And as I said earlier on, I don't think this is something which leads to painful, bad economic outcomes. It leads to good things: more jobs, technology acceleration, more energy security, cleaner air. We have all these things waiting there, but we do have to move on them. And actually, the other thing you said, which I think is really significant and which I very much welcome as well, is the intervention of organizations like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund on this recently, because, you know, these are the organizations that talk around sound economics and the job of poverty reduction. And both of them are saying you can't have a sound economy, one that's going to last, and you can't have poverty reduction until you deal with these big environmental challenges, because the big environmental challenges will be the biggest enemies of development and the biggest enemies of economic growth in the future. And I'm so delighted that they've got that and they're now saying it.
Well, George?
Yeah, I think it's very critical that the whole idea of setting a correct price on the fossil fuels, because it's having such a negative impact, and in order to have a strong economy, you need to set the correct price. And this is something that's being recognized by economists in the United States across the political spectrum.
All righty, guys. We're gonna have to leave it there because we're running out of time, but Tony Juniper, I'm going to take you up on your willingness to stay up some evening and engage with us yet again.
Yeah, I'd be delighted. Thanks ever so much. It was great to talk and great to hear people phoning in and to be able to exchange a few ideas.
The book is What Has Nature Ever Done for Us? It's published by Synergetic Press. Tony Juniper was our guest, and next week we'll be talking to House Bill 77. Thanks to Dave Waldron, Tristan Sammons, and Monica Gokey on the crew. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Providence Imaging Center, with its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, ultrasound, and digital X-ray to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through PicClickGive or contributing to a college savings plan.
This message is sponsored by the state of Alaska. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.